Might as well start. I'm Karen Bauer with the Basel One Center, and I did want to talk about campus mental health. What I'd like to do is to talk generally about the practices, how we've seen them come up in the cases, and then talk about, what's going on. Sort of what are they thinking? What's motivating universities to take this action, and how are they defending it? And we can certainly proceed if you have any questions. Let's address them rather than waiting till the end. But first, I think it comes in an overall climate where we're talking about the unmet needs of students. The unmet mental health needs for students who are in campus. There's all kinds of publicity out there about campus mental health issues and college suicide. And in this whole climate, the real world message that students are getting is actually very different. The message that they're getting is much more equivocal as schools are adopting more and more policies that are intrusive and draconian that tend to basically terminate a student's academic career and expel them from school. Besides the direct implications for the students themselves, these policies often have unintended consequences of discouraging students from getting mental health treatment and discouraging them from getting treatment for friends who may be in need. So what are the practices specifically? There's three that I've seen that basically, in response to a student who expresses any type of self-injurious thought or self-injurious action, and it's not just suicide, it's not limited. We're also seeing it in terms of students who have eating disorders and students who engage in other kinds of self-injury like cutting. But the reaction is to impose a mandatory or involuntary leave of absence. And that's either a leave of absence from the dormitory or residence hall or a leave of absence from the university as a whole. The other way that schools deal with it is by imposing disciplinary charges. And those are charges that stem from some rule in the school code of conduct or from a housing contract that prohibits any type of injury or dangerous behavior or threats. So those policies are enforced against the individual who articulates any kind of self-harm. So I can give you examples of each of these. These are cases that were brought by the Basel One Center or with co-counsel. The first case that we heard of was I got a call from an attorney in New York who had a case of a student. And his initial question was, what is suicide contagion? So that was a defense that was raised by in the Hunter College case, and he didn't know what that was. So I started by saying, well, what is suicide contagion? And suicide, there's a couple of phenomena that he could be talking about. One of them is that during certain times of year, suicide tends to be more prevalent. And maybe around exam time or around winter time when days are shorter, there's a greater incidence of suicide. But I didn't think that's what he meant when he said, what's suicide contagion? And the other definition, suicide contagion is really a media phenomena. And it's this phenomena that is, if the media reports on a suicide and they do so in a sensationalized manner without talking about underlying mental health issues and report it in this sensationalized manner that makes it look like a really attractive alternative that other students may read about it and may themselves then copycat and make suicide attempts. But I wasn't sure that didn't seem to me to be what he was talking about either, because that really doesn't apply. So the facts of the case, and I'll get to what they might have meant by suicide contagion when we talk about what their defenses and claims are. But in that case, the student, a young woman, I believe she was at the time 19 years old, had a long history of depression, and she had been she'd been dealing with her depression for a long time. She had been taking medication, and she was fairly successful in. She had to take some time off from school in high school, but she was really succeeding. She was doing well. She was a straight A student. She was in Hunter College. She was in the honors program, and that entitled her to dormitory housing. And she was taking antidepressants, and she did have therapists that she saw regularly. With her first year of college, she started feeling really good. She thought she was doing really well, and didn't need to continue taking her medication. And with the craziness of first year of college, where people stay up all night and study and sleep part of the day and get all wrapped up in exams and the kind of constant studying for exams, she got off her routine and stopped taking her medication, stopped seeing her therapists, and slowly started cycling down, and really was in crisis. And one night, she, and in part in reaction to migraine headaches, but she took about 20 Tylenol, and then she realized what she did, and she called 911, was voluntarily taken to the hospital, and was admitted for treatment. She was there for a few days, and there, you know, she got stabilized and got back on her medication regime, reconnected with her counselors, had a discharge plan in place, and really was ready to go back to school. All of her counselors supported her return to school. She's discharged from the hospital, and she returns to her dorm to find that the locks had been changed. And she had no place to stay that night. She had to find a place, and for the next few days as well, she wasn't allowed back into the dormitory. She was allowed to continue to attend school, but I really struggled to figure out, what are they doing here? How does this make any sense? I mean, I imagine, how does it feel to go on vacation? Something everybody can relate to. You go on vacation, you come back, and all you really want to do is return and sleep in your own bed and take a shower in your own room. And here she's being discharged from the hospital, and she's trying to get into her room, and she can't. And how horrible that must have been for her. And I've talked to a number of students who have experienced the same type of thing, and the result is that they have no place to stay. If they're in a city like New York, and you know it's a local school and they have family there, they can stay with family or friends and continue to go to school. But in more rural areas, kicking someone out of the dormitory really is tantamount to kicking them out of school, because they have no place to stay. And I've talked to students who have been referred to homeless shelters, who have lived in their cars so that they can continue to attend school, have had to stay in hotel rooms, and even though they've paid for the dormitory, have had to rent outside apartments just so that they can continue to go to school. And the additional stress on the students as they're waiting for the university to determine what they can do, whether they're going to be allowed back into the campus or the dormitory, is really unbelievable, and much, you know, it doesn't help them in any way. So the school's clearly not thinking about the student and how this they can benefit the student and help them to succeed at school. So I was so appalled by the case and intrigued by this idea of suicidal ideation that rather than assisting the attorneys in the case, I asked if I could join as co-counsel. And so this began our work on the Hunter College case. As I was getting into this issue, I heard of another case that one of the local PNAs got a case, Protection Advocacy Agencies got a case, and they were asking some questions about it, and they didn't have the resources to take it, so I said I would. This is a New England boarding school, and the student involved was about 15 years old, and she had not had any history of depression, but her mother noticed that she started being withdrawn, and this was a day student, and asked the school counselor to talk to her. And so she did establish a relationship with the school counselor, and in that relationship she disclosed that she had been cutting. The school counselor said, I'm going to have to tell your mother about this, which the student really wasn't very happy about. And as the counselor over that day and the next day tried to contact the mother, learned that the student had not come to school, was concerned about the student, called, and the student admitted she had taken about 15 Tylenol and spent the morning throwing up. The counselor was very concerned and suggested that she needed treatment, so the student agreed to go into inpatient treatment, and she was treated and released and returned to school to finish the year. The next semester she's in school, and some friends hacked into an online journal of hers that was private. Now, we're not talking something you've posted at MySpace or one of those, you know, I don't even remember the names of these. There's a number of sites out there where kids have posted a lot of really scary stuff. this was not one of those. This was a private journal that she was keeping, and friends hacked into it. And imagine what a 16-year-old girl is writing in her private diary when she's feeling depressed and hopeless. Well, that's the kind of stuff that was in there. And they were concerned about it, and they brought it to their guidance counselor, who shared it with her guidance counselor, who contacted the mother and asked for permission to talk to her psychologist and shared this information. And the student said, you know, you're right. You know, I have depression. I'm not suicidal, but I really need more help than I'm getting. I need something a little bit more intensive. And she agreed to go in for inpatient counseling over the Thanksgiving break. So she missed, I believe, one day of class. While she was in the hospital, she got a note from the school saying that she was placed on involuntary leave of absence. She could not return. She was on leave for the remainder of the academic year. And all of these cases, that when they get that letter, there's also a whole bunch of conditions that you have to comply with in order to return at the end of that period of leave, such as during the period of leave, you have to be in counseling. When you return, you have to give us access to your counselor, and we have to continue to have access to that counselor throughout the remainder of the year. You have to agree to stay in counseling and, you know, stay on track.
What do you mean, access to your counselor? They have to divulge the ability to get information about your treatment?
You sign a consent to speak with the counselor, and it's not, I allow you to speak with her for the next 4 days to get information about my situation to determine whether I can return. It's, you have ongoing consent from now until the end of the school year, and at any time you can speak with my counselor. So different schools, of course, require different things, but that's one I've seen a fair amount of. That we want to be able to constantly talk to that person. And in one of our, yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, that's how I first learned of the case, was this question about suicide contagion, which was a defense that that was being raised in the Hunter case. I'll talk about the defenses and the rationale behind it, or what we presume that rationale is, in after describing the whole context. But they do have these really onerous conditions that they place on students for them in order for them to return and in order for them to stay in school. And they did the same in both of these cases.
What other conditions is that?
I think conditions that you go into counseling, that you stay in counseling, that we have access to your counselor, which actually,
medication,
if you are on medication, if that's part of your treatment, yes, you have to remain compliant with your treatment plan, whatever that means. If you leave your counselor a change, they prefer that you contact the school counselor and let them know in advance. And some have said things like, you know, well, we, you know, you have to, not only do you have to see your counselor and report to us and allow us access, some have said you have to report to us as well. So you have to come to us on a weekly basis or a bi-monthly basis and confirm that you're still in counseling and give us reports and things like that. No, it's completely outside of that. But in this case, the student got this letter saying that she was not able to return to school and that she was placed on leave. And her therapists, of course, were completely behind her return to school and felt that it was really beneficial for her to be in school. She was very invested in it, and that it would be detrimental to her to ask her to leave school. And I was interested in the case because, to me, it's particularly appalling. In college, it's one thing to say to somebody, you know, you can't attend this college. Secondary school is more of a choice. You can go someplace else. I'm not saying this is a good thing. It's not a good thing. But for somebody who's in high school, this student, number one, has her parent involved, and number two, is mandated to get an education. So them saying you're on mandatory leave, you can't be in school, is tantamount to saying you have to go someplace else. You know, you have to go to school, you just can't go here. And it was particularly appalling to me, and so we took this case as well. And then at the same time as I was getting involved in these cases, I read an article in the city paper about Jordan Knott, who had attended the George Washington University. And so I contacted him initially to be a witness and to help explain some of what had gone on, and we wound up representing him. But Jordan, again, had never had any history of depression or any mental illness. He was a student at the school, and he had a very close friend, Hassan Hussein, who did commit suicide. Jordan and Hassan were very close. They had intended to room together the next year, and Hassan did experience depression. He was receiving treatment, and he contacted his friends. He basically called them and said something along the lines of, "Tomorrow I want you to act like today was any other day." And his friends were really concerned and ran to his room, were standing outside the door trying to get in when he jumped from his window. Jordan was one of those students outside the door, and he was devastated. He finished the school year, the summer came along, and then the next semester, the one in which he was supposed to live with his friend, he started experiencing depression, which should be no surprise to anyone. The APA had put out guidelines that talk about basically 80% of people who have very close friends or family members who commit suicide later experience depression and other types of mental illness. So not surprisingly, Jordan did too. And he became depressed. He sought counseling at the University Counseling Center and began taking antidepressants. When you're at the counseling center, they tell you there's a number of things that you can do if you want help. You can contact a hotline. You can come in and see a counselor. If no one's there, you can call somebody. You can see them the next day during work hours, or you can go to the hospital. So one night, when he began having thoughts of harming himself, and those thoughts really freaked him out, and he was really scared. He had not experienced that before, and he was not actively suicidal, but he was really scared. He knew about what could happen when you begin taking antidepressants, that you could have a negative reaction to them, that you could start having symptoms, suicidal thoughts. And so he asked a friend to take him to the emergency room, and he voluntarily committed himself to the hospital, or voluntarily admitted himself, I should say, for assessment. He was in the hospital. The following day, he got a letter from the university saying, because you have been hospitalized, you need to receive clearance before you can return to your dorm. And at first I thought, well, that's not very different from what happened at Hunter College, and you have to jump through a couple of hoops before you can return to your dorm. But then the following day he got a letter saying that you have violated the school code of conduct, which prohibits endangering behavior. And as a result of this violation, there's going to be a disciplinary hearing held, and you can appear at that hearing and testify. And if you are found guilty of endangering behavior, whatever that means, then you face suspension or expulsion from the school. In the meantime, until such time as we can have this hearing, you're placed on interim suspension. You're suspended from your dormitory, you're suspended from the school. If you appear on campus, you will be considered trespassing and could be arrested. And it was not just if you appear on campus, but if you're in any campus or any property owned by the campus, like Lisner Auditorium, like any sporting event that anybody can go to, that if he wanted to see his counselor, that would be on campus property, and he would not be able to do that. So rather than face these disciplinary charges and really ruin his academic career by having disciplinary charges against him followed by a suspension or an expulsion, he chose to withdraw from the university. Jordan, by the way, has graduated from the University of Maryland. He did so after 3 years. His entire college career took 3 years. That case was particularly disturbing because I don't know what endangering behavior is. I can't seem to figure that one out, because it seemed everything he did was self-preserving and not in any way endangering. So I'm not really clear where they were going or what their defense might have been on that. But all of these cases sort of demonstrate the range of actions that I've seen out there in campus mental health cases, and all of them are really concerning for us because they're so wrong-headed, that not only do they increase the risk of suicide for the individual who's subject to these policies, but they also send the wrong message to everyone else. They discourage people from getting any kind of mental health treatment, from disclosing if they're feeling depressed or suicidal, and it increases the dangerousness for everybody on the campus. It also tells that individual student a message that there's something wrong with you, that you did something wrong, that you're not good enough, that you're a failure, that you don't belong here. And that's really problematic, especially coming from an academic institution. There's kind of a range of responses to that. One is, you know, legally, what can they do? And the other is practically, the student has to act quickly, and they don't want to be separated from the university. And asking for a letter is kind of on the low end of the continuum of offensive acts that a university can take. And I kind of look at it, how does it compare with how a school would respond if a student was hospitalized for physical, you know, physical health problem? They broke a leg, they were hospitalized. What do they need in order to come back? They've got TB, they need a letter. And so is that an okay thing for them to ask for? And, you know, they're claiming that they're fearful that the person may, because of their hospitalization, not be qualified for the program, and may constitute a threat, what's called a direct threat, and therefore not be qualified for the program. And so they can, it seems to me, they can ask for some assurance that would say that they can participate in the program. Well, I think you have to break it down into segments and look at it. So going forward, here it sounds like they're offering some kind of reasonable accommodation, that instead of this imposed leave of absence, they're allowing her to submit a letter. And so if she turns that down and says no, you know, you can't say, well, this accommodation would have been better instead of this accommodation, and I'm not willing to comply with that. It sounds like she might lose. Or if there were any case that began at the time that they began their response, it would certainly be cut off as of the date that she refused to comply and provide the letter. As for the past period of time, I don't think that they're now changing their tune is any different. I think you still have the same causes of action and claims that you would have had she contacted you and had you been involved a year ago. And there'd be violations of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Rehab Act, the Fair Housing Act, perhaps if a residence was involved under any kind of state or local human rights act. And then in our cases, I also threw in claims for intentional and or negligent infliction of emotional distress, for privacy violations, and for, you know, mental health records type violations. And I think you'd have those exact same claims. By the time it was brought, if she was back in school, you wouldn't have really an ADA claim, because that's for injunctive relief. You may have a claim under the Rehab Act if they took federal funds for damages, but under the State Human Rights Act, you would have a claim for damages. And to have them change the policy so that she's not subject to the same policy going forward. Actually, in the Hunter College case, that's what happened. She was suspended. The lawyers that were initially involved moved for a preliminary injunction, and it seemed like the judge was going to grant it, but and before he issued the ruling, the other side said, but well, let's see if we can work this out. Let's give her an evaluation and see if we can allow her back in. And so they did this Mickey Mouse evaluation and then said, of course, oh, she's not ready to come back in. And by then, the judge really wasn't ruling on the preliminary injunction, and then he just denied it at that point. And so while we were litigating, you know, time just kept marching on, and so the year suspension period passed, and she desperately wanted to go back to school. And so they put in place several conditions that were, they were more onerous than just that note, and she agreed to them. And went back to school and started feeling like she was in a fishbowl, that everything she did was being watched by administration, that she, that you're in school and all of a sudden you're gone in the middle of the semester, everybody knows. Everybody wonders, gee, where'd you go? What happened to you? You just disappeared. How come you're back? What's going on? Where have you been? And so she felt that she had no privacy whatsoever. Everybody knew her business. Everybody knew what was going on. And it was very embarrassing for her. And she felt like people were all talking about her. She felt very isolated, and it turned out to be a horrible experience to go back. So I think she'd have, and we argued that imposing those conditions, we agreed to have her return, but we weren't waiving any claims that we had, that those conditions constituted additional discrimination. And so we were claiming discrimination for the first time, and then additional acts of discrimination for imposing those conditions on her, even though she agreed to go back to school. We weren't waiving our rights. Well, in the high school student's case, it's obvious they were in touch with the therapist and knew that the student went there. In the Hunter College case, as what often happens is it's a dormitory, and so there are people on site, there's security on site and residence advisors, and when an ambulance comes and takes a student to the hospital, they know, you know, yeah, so they know what happened. He walked over, yeah, he walked by himself. He asked a friend because he was also taking Ambien, and he was afraid that taking Ambien, and it was late at night, and he wanted to make sure he got there safely. So as an additional safety measure, he brought friends. We settled the case before we got a lot of the discovery. So I can't say for certain, but what I see happening is, and what may have happened here, is that the hospital contacted the student's mental health treatment provider, which would have been the school counselor. So that is probably okay, if that's all that happened, that's probably okay. Then... If they ask you, can we contact your mental health treatment provider? People usually say yes, and hospitals routinely will contact treatment providers.
I think with the kids who are,
so he would have said, oh yeah, you know, that's a good thing. Everybody's all concerned about my well-being. Of course you can contact my counselor. And so it seems to me the real breach occurred that the counselor contacted the administration, and immediately, I mean, it was so egregious that he's in the psychiatric ward, and, you know, it's a locked ward, there's specific hours, and the school personal administrator was able to come into the dorm after hours and hand him these letters telling him, you know, thanks for playing, you're now expelled from school, whereas his mother couldn't get in because it was after hours, and so she...
The administrator came into the hospital.
Yeah. Into a locked ward and was allowed in by the doctors and sat there and gave them this letter. So, I mean, the policies, they really are, they're so horrible, and, you know, societally as well, it's, you know, some of the most creative people that are here being expelled from school. So what is going on? As I said, you know, we sued under the ADA and under the Rehab Act. And the ADA, the claims are that, that these policies constitute discrimination, and that they fail to provide students with the full and equal enjoyment of goods, programs, or services, that they exclude the students from participation in and deny them the opportunity to participate in the goods, services, and programs, and that they have criteria and methods of administration that have the effect of subjecting students to discrimination, and that they fail to provide reasonable accommodation. And same arguments are made under the Fair Housing Act, pretty much, that not only is it discrimination, but it has a disparate impact on students with a handicap under the Rehab Act, and again, a failure to provide accommodation. So what's motivating the schools primarily is probably a fear of liability. At least that's one of the arguments that they make. And in Hunter, they said that CUNY is, quote, entitled to be proactive and protect itself from a future lawsuit which could result from any further attempts by a plaintiff to harm herself. And the school then went on to cite all of these examples of cases that were brought for failure to protect from suicide. So it seems to me, while that's an argument that they're making, and courts may be, and people may be somewhat sympathetic to it, if you parse it, it really isn't a very strong argument that in order to have liability for something like failure to protect, what you have to have is a duty, a breach of the duty, there has to be causation, and then there has to be harm, and the harm has to be foreseeable. And historically, courts rejected this kind of duty for a number of reasons. First, they found that suicide was an intervening cause, and so therefore it defeated causation. And then the second reason was that they felt that that there was no duty. That basically, in order for there to be a duty, there had to be a custodial relationship, like in prison or in jail, or there had to be some kind of a special relationship, as in a hospital inpatient facility, a residential treatment facility. But failing that, there really wasn't any duty, except for professional malpractice, the duty of a counselor to provide the standard of care. But failing that, there was no duty. So the question in these that comes up is there a duty to prevent suicide or to protect a student from suicide? And I think that the answer is ultimately going to be no, because I can't see them imposing a greater duty on schools than they're going to put on mental health treatment providers. So that's where I am. But there are a number of cases, and in fact, there are a lot of cases that have found that there is no duty. But there are a couple of cases that occurred recently where the case was filed and it survived a motion to dismiss. And because it survived a motion to dismiss and was headed towards trial, schools got all freaked out and thought, well, maybe that means that they're going to find that there is a duty. And there are two cases in particular. One of them involved Ferrum College. I think it was Frenzel versus Ferrum College, and the other was Shin versus MIT. And in both of those cases, in Ferrum College, it was a student who was very clear. He told his ex-girlfriend that he was going to hang himself. And she told school administrators, who went to his room and found him with marks around his neck. And he admitted, though he were self-inflicted, he had tried to kill himself. And they said, well, you really need to get help. And he agreed that he would seek treatment. I think that was the extent of their involvement. And he continued to write notes over the next few days to his ex-girlfriend and to others, saying things along the lines of, only God can help me now, I will always love you. Again, she told the administrators, and they then proceeded to interview several other people. They talked to the ex-girlfriend, they prohibited her from speaking to him, and by the time they ultimately got to him, he had successfully killed himself. And the Shin case, again, similar types of situation in which the student had been in contact with students with the school counseling center. She had a long history of depression and had made many, had discussed suicide many times. I believe she had made a previous attempt. And the school was actively working to get her into an intensive program, which she agreed she needed. Nonetheless, while they were working to do this, and there was some delay in ultimately getting the program for her, she said, I'm going to kill myself tonight. And they said, well, you know, we're really working hard to get her into that program. And she killed herself that night. It's unclear whether it was accidental. But nonetheless, the school was then sued for failure to prevent the daughter's suicide. Both of those cases were settled. So they did both survive a motion to dismiss, and MIT case survived a motion for summary judgment and was headed towards trial, I believe, it was pending, I think. I think a motion for summary judgment was pending and the case was settled. But I think the language that the Virginia court in the Ferrum College case used was you know, it sort of says what the court's reasoning is. And they said, this was brought in Virginia, that while it's unlikely that Virginia would conclude that a special relationship exists as a matter of law between colleges and universities and their students, it might find that a special relationship exists on the particular facts alleged in this case. He was a full-time student. He lived in an on-campus dormitory. Defendants were aware he had emotional problems. Defendants knew of his self-inflicted injuries. Defendants knew of his communications that he intended to kill himself. A trier of fact could conclude that there was an imminent probability that he would try to hurt himself and that defendants had notice of that specific harm. Thus, the plaintiff alleged sufficient facts to support a claim that a special relationship existed between him and the defendants, giving rise to a duty to protect Frenzel from the foreseeable danger that he would hurt himself. So there's some thought that maybe in this case, based on these facts, that they stopped the girlfriend from coming to see him, it seems to me kind of like being at a roadside accident and saying, don't worry, I'll call 911, and then failing to do so, but because you said you would do it, you prevented other people from aiding. And so there's kind of an element of failure, you know, interference with someone else providing assistance and then your own inaction. So I'm not really clear that here the court, you know, had this gone to trial, the court would have found, well, there really is a special relationship, there really is a duty, and you breached it. But we won't know. We won't ever know because the case did settle. But that is sort of the tension in the law, that the more a university knows about something, the more we hear publicity about suicide, the more there are studies about how prevalent suicide is on campus, the more schools take actions in response by having counseling centers and suicide prevention awareness programs, that the more that they do, the more liability they potentially incur. And we've seen the same thing along with drinking on campus and hazing and sexual assault as it becomes more prevalent, as we know the incidents on campus, as we take actions to stop it by putting in lights and putting in buzzer boxes and emergency alarms. As the schools take more and more actions to prevent it, do they, by doing so, expose themselves to liability for some mistake?
Well, as those students learn the potential of what happens for fear of the repercussion on doing so. So it's going backwards.
Right. Right here, I mean, I could easily see that happening, that because of the school's policy, there's another student who doesn't get help, and then that student does, unfortunately, successfully kill themselves. There would be a lawsuit. But there is this tension that, you know, where is liability? Is there liability or isn't there? And as a matter of law, can we say that there's not liability, but in certain fact situations, maybe there is.
Joshua Cheney gets, you know, just demolished by his father, and, you know, now he's, I don't even know if he's still alive, but, I mean, how can they be even remotely scared of liability? I mean, what you just said just doesn't make any sense to me in terms of this whole, you know, I have a duty when there's only really, only two things: it's the prison or locked unit. And if they expand it to that for the schools, they'd be opening up a whole can of worms for everybody else.
What they might do, I mean, I could see them carving a very narrow area where what they did wrong in both of these situations seems to me is somebody said, "I'm going to kill myself," and they said, "Well, good luck with that. We'll see you tomorrow. Come keep your appointment with us." And it seems to me that where they're going to come down is say, if somebody makes a suicide threat, they have to be immediately assessed. And that's what both of these schools did wrong, that they didn't act really promptly. In the Ferrum College case, they said, "Oh, well, we're really glad you agreed to get treatment. You know, have you gotten treatment yet? Have you gotten a program?" And in the Shin case, she said, "I'm going to kill myself tonight." And they said, "Well, we're really working on getting you into a program." And so it seems to me both students were expressing a really immediate problem, and their response was not immediate. And so that may be where the court comes out in
That's
saying.
That's very different than the other cases that you're talking about.
The other cases, the cases that we litigated. Right. I mean, in all of these cases, the student says, "I'm going to admit myself into the hospital," and there, where they're in terms of the school's perception, they're in the safest place possible, right? They're already, any imminent danger has passed. They're currently in a secure facility. Somebody else is watching out over them. And so, you know, what's the immediate action that the school needs to take? It's you know, the flip side, almost, of these concerns.
There would be that, you know, because we knew, it's almost like saying, you know, "I'm going to kill myself. Now I know you've been to a psychiatric facility for suicide, and you're coming back and you have this history, but I need to have some assurance, because I'm just an administrator, I'm not a psychiatrist, and some assurances, and the assurances are that it has to be a bit more long-term, because we all know, statistically, that people who are going to kill themselves, and you know, there's all these studies or whatever, is that it's not right after you got out of the hospital, but later on they got out of the hospital, like some amount of months or whatever, and this would be their argument. You know, you can find any sort of statistic you want, and say that you need to have this particular, you know, long-term sort of scrutiny over these college kids.
Right, and that the greatest threat arises in a change in setting. So upon discharge is one of the times of greatest threat. And so that's why if you're going to have a change of setting, then that change is going to be from hospital to home and not to here. So, you know, I think the universities are struggling with that. That's really a question for them. What do
we... And there's no case law on this, right? We know, like, actual sort of... So you'd be very careful to make that law and that set of facts to the case.
Yeah, there's one case in New York. It was called, I think, Doe versus New York, and it was a medical student. And she I think, attempted suicide, and she was also using drugs that she was dispensing because she was a medical student. And in those circumstances where she had lied on her application to medical school and not admitted that she had any history of problems and that she was also had been somewhat assaultive, in that case, under those facts, they found that they could kick her out of school because she wasn't qualified for the program. But in these cases of students who really just go and get treatment for serious depression and suicidal ideation, you know, we haven't seen anything like that. And there's no report, there are no, that I've seen, no reported cases on it. Aside from the liability defense, which is, you know, I think not a very strong one, and not really legally grounded. I mean, it's, you know, I don't think they're going to get a court to say there's a duty here. No court has done it, and there's a lot of case law on the other side saying that there is no duty. So I don't think that that's a real problem. The other argument that schools make to support this is to say that the student isn't qualified. And on the surface, that seems like a ridiculous argument, because to be qualified, I mean, and there are a couple of decisions by the Department of Education Office of Civil Rights that talk about what it means to be qualified. And to be qualified is really to get admission to the school, to pay, and to meet the academic standards. And so clearly these students are qualified. So it seems to me that they're really saying something else, that they're qualified, but they've breached something like a code of conduct or a housing agreement. And they raised that argument in the CUNY case and said that she breached the housing agreement and she's not qualified because in light of her recent history of self-harm, residence halls in have a certain level of stressors involved, and you have to be able to deal with the stressors of campus life and dormitory living in order to be qualified to be here. And if you can't kind of withstand emotionally those stressors, then you're not qualified to be here. And they followed that up by saying, you know, you really don't meet the independent living criteria of the residence hall. And that argument itself has to fail because it's inherently discriminatory. And so if that's what they're basing it on, it seems to me that they're going to lose. And so if you parse it a little deeper, what they're really saying about when they're saying a person isn't qualified, it gets back to this whole suicide contagion idea. What they're saying is basically you're not qualified because you're a direct threat to other people. Now, schools have had a very hard time explaining how a student is a direct threat to other people when they're suicidal, and they're engaging in things like taking pills. But they have raised a whole bunch of explanations, like this behavior is really disturbing to other students, that other students, like your roommates, are having to feel like they have to take care of you instead of attend to their own classes, and so it's really disturbing academically to them, that we're afraid that other people might copycat, and that we're getting phone calls from parents of other students that it's disruptive to have you in the dormitory. And so they're kind of glomming all of this stuff together and making this threat that the student isn't qualified because they constitute a direct threat to other students and to the campus community as a whole. And while we didn't get a ruling on it, I think that's a particularly weak argument for a number of reasons. First, direct threat is defined as a significant risk to the health or safety of others. That is not a low standard. It has to be significant, and so to rise to the level of a significant threat, there has to be a high probability that the injury is going to occur. And that means not a slightly increased one, not a speculative one, not a remote one, but a high probability that this is likely to recur. And with all those statistics that are out there, no one can predict who is likely to commit suicide. Even if you have had a previous attempt, there's an increased likelihood, but no one can predict who's got a high probability of making another attempt. If in order to in order, if you are making the argument that a student is a direct threat, what a college has to do is to make an individualized assessment of the student to see if they can safely participate in the programs, and it has to be based on a reasonable medical judgment that relies on current medical knowledge and best available objective evidence. It seems to me that to the extent that they're issuing these blanket policies at the time that someone is admitted into the hospital, that is A, not an individualized assessment, and it's B, not based on the most recent objective medical information, because that information would be obtained at the time of discharge, not at the time of admission. So for that reason alone, I think it's really problematic. And then further, the assessment has to determine the nature, duration, and severity of the risk, the probability that it will occur, and whether or not there's any kind of mitigating measures that they can take to reduce the probability. So again, all of these cases where you enter the hospital and you get a letter, they just don't meet that standard. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the kids who have been subject to these policies, they're not that interested in litigating. They really want to move on. They want to get into school or stay in school. They don't want to admit what happened. They just want to move on with their lives. And so I haven't seen a lot about that. What I have heard of is on-campus groups, like Active Minds, that are developing now, student groups that advocate for disability rights, do encourage students to, if you get, definitely get help, but go off campus. And so I've heard a lot more of that, of groups saying, don't get services here, which schools are really upset with because they think that they have these phenomenal programs and that they help hundreds of students. And it's really these outlier students that are causing the problems. And I've heard that a number of times that there's really much more. There's much more to Jordan Knott's case. And there's much more to the case of the student at Hunter. And they were really much more severely disabled than you're admitting. And the harm was much more imminent. And there's just not any validity to that. So to the extent that they're making this argument, the person isn't qualified, the person is a direct threat, I don't think that that's a very good argument. I think it's easily challenged under the ADA and the Fair Housing Act. The other argument that schools are making is I'm particularly offended by this argument as well, which is that we're taking this action not based on disability, that we're reacting to the conduct, that it's not the depression that bothers us, it's that you engaged in a suicide act. And we would take the same act, we would have the same response whether or not the student had a disability. So if a student engages in a suicide attempt after drinking or after the breakup of a relationship, then that's the behavior that we're after. And it has absolutely nothing to do with disability. And I find that especially ridiculous because there are so many studies out there that talk about suicide attempts, and 90% of people who attempt suicide suffer from severe depression, and for those people who haven't been diagnosed as having depression, most professionals believe that it's just undiagnosed, not that it's not there. That if you weren't suffering from depression at the breakup of a relationship, you would probably not attempt to kill yourself. And so the ADA protects not just against discrimination, it prohibits discrimination by reason of disability, but it also prohibits discrimination based on the effects of any kind of impairment, whether those effects are personal. I'm sorry? Yeah, and whether those are effects on yourself or on other people. And so in the law, there's really no distinction between discrimination based on disability or discrimination based on disability-caused conduct or even disability-caused misconduct. All of those are protected. And so this argument is I think, especially weak. There's only a couple of other issues that come up in these cases. One of them is confidentiality, and a lot of people get really upset about the confidentiality issues and the breach. And I think those issues are really important, but for a number of reasons, not central. I mean, we've been focusing not on the confidentiality, but on the school's response. And the reason is that I think the tone in a university is really set from the top down. And a student should be able to go to the dean of students, the president of the college, and say, I'm really experiencing depression and I'm feeling like killing myself. And the response should be, let's help you get help, instead of let's kick you out of school. And so if you take the confidentiality piece out of it, the responses are and policies are still problematic. But confidentiality is a big piece of it, and it seems to me that, you know, there may be another way to challenge the confidentiality piece, like through using professional ethics standards. Because it seems to me, if you're a counselor and you work for a university, and your job is possibly to tell a student, I don't think you can be here, because it may be a problem for the school, then you have a conflict of interest. You can't both serve the university and serve the student. You have to have one person who is your client, and it can't be both. And if the counselor is in a position where they're going to either turn your records over to administration or tell you that I'm going to participate in a decision that says you can't be here, that they have a conflict of interest, and I don't see how they can establish a therapeutic relationship with someone and form trust. I mean, there can be a firewall between administration and counseling, where counseling can get information from the administration but can't share it, where the university pays them but provides for a separate independent liability insurance for them. And I think that their decisions just need to be really independent, because otherwise it's really problematic to me. So those are all the comments I was going to make initially. I'm happy to answer any questions about these cases. By the way, both of them, the GW case settled 2 weeks ago in the Hunter College, and it was a confidential settlement. The Hunter College case settled, I think it was in August. And because Hunter College is a public institution, the settlement agreement was public. We posted it on the Bazelon website, and they did agree to change their policy and withdrew. This policy was in place for about 3 years. They withdrew the policy, and they're replacing it with one that will provide for individualized assessments, and they have also stated that they're going to put counselors in the dorms, and it will apply to the entire SUNY system. So that was really encouraging.